6-year-old Seals was operating a roof bolter at Pittston's Triple C mine in Dickinson County when the accident occurred. Pittston officials have said the roof of the mine did not collapse, but no other details on the accident have been released. Federal officials are investigating. Meanwhile, contract talks between the union and Pittston resumed today after a 2-week layoff. Pittston officials want the two sides to take turns choosing bargaining sites and want to move next week's talks to New York. The union says it would agree to Pittston's request only if the company agrees to face-to-face negotiations. Talks currently are taking place in separate motel rooms with federal mediators acting as messengers. For National Public Radio, I'm Chris Roberts in Roanoke.
Costa Rica reportedly is close to clinching a deal that will considerably reduce its commercial debt. Bankers said today the deal could be announced within a week and will include debt buybacks and swaps of existing debt. This is NPR News in Washington. I'm Frank Stacio.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. Is the universe finite or infinite? Why are sunsets beautiful displays of color? My guest, James Treffel, writes about the complexities of the visible world and the mysteries of the cosmos. He's a physicist who's able to interpret the latest scientific theories and science history for people who aren't science experts. Treffel has done science commentators for NPR's Morning Edition, and he's the Clarence J. Robinson Professor of Physics at George Mason University. His book, The Dark Side of the Universe, has just been published in paperback. His new book, Reading the Mind of God, is an explanation of the principle of universality.
The principle of universality is one of those ideas that's so simple that you never even think about it. But what the idea is that the laws of nature that we discover by looking in laboratories on Earth right now apply everywhere in the universe, out to billions of light years away, and apply at all times in the past. The reason I say this is surprising is that if you look at the Earth the way an astronomer looks at it, as one little pebble going around one very undistinguished sun in a very normal galaxy, one among billions of galaxies, the idea that at this one place we could discover how this whole machine works is really astounding.
Well, I think I approve one of your theory being that it's taken for granted by scientists, this principle of universality.
Exactly.
But it comes as a real shock to a lot of lay people, and I think I fit in that latter category.
Well, exactly. The reason I wrote this book, Reading the Mind of God, is because I discovered that. I would give a talk to a lay audience, and I'd just throw this out in passing, and there'd be this sense of shock that, well, what do you mean by that? And I quickly learned that although scientists know about this and take it for granted, lay people don't. And that got me interested as to, well, how do scientists know this, and how did we discover this rather astonishing fact? And that's really sort of my journey of discovery that I chronicle in this book.
Now, what rules, what kind of laws of science that apply on Earth are we talking about that also apply in the rest of the cosmos?
Well, the universe is run by a very small number of natural laws. That's one of the great insights of modern science, that maybe a dozen or 15 laws, conservation of energy, Newton's laws of motion, things like that, describe everything. And the science of physics, in fact, is devoted to taking all the millions and millions of things that we see and reducing their essence down to this small number of natural laws. And what we find is that if we look at what happens on Earth and we look at what happens in a quasar 15 billion light years away, the laws are the same.
How do we know this, since we can't go that far and test it out?
Yeah, we can't actually get a piece of that quasar and bring it to our lab, but we can get something that's almost as good, which is we can get light and radio waves and X-rays and other kinds of things that come from the quasar to us. Now, if you think about it for a minute, when you say, you know, we have something in our laboratory, what does that mean? Well, if you remember your college chemistry, you know, very often you would take a chemical and you'd put it in a fire and see what color it was. You know, if it was blue, it was copper. You might remember some of that kind of thing. Well, what you're doing there is the light is going from the copper to you. The only difference between that little sample of copper you're holding in your hand and a quasar is that the copper is a few feet away and the quasar is billions of light years away. But from the point of view of physics, it doesn't make any difference. You're getting the same information from each.
Now, you trace our knowledge of the principle of universality back to Newton.
Mm-hmm.
How did he come upon it?
Well, of course, there's the famous story of the apple. He lived in a world where people had what we would now say, I don't like to use the word primitive, but let me just use that. I can't think of a better word. Primitive ideas about how the solar system worked. And they believed that whatever it was that kept the planets moving around the sun was very different from the things that made things fall on the Earth. And according to Newton, he was walking in an orchard one day, and he saw an apple fall. And at the same time, he saw behind the apple, he saw the moon in the sky. And it suddenly struck him that the force that was pulling on the apple probably was pulling on the moon as well. And it led him to think that maybe there weren't two different kinds of forces in the universe, but only one kind, what we now call the force of gravity. And it made the apple fall, and it kept the moon in the orbit, and it kept the Earth going around the sun, and so forth. So this was the first step to realize that the Earth is not special, that the Earth is very typical of the rest of the universe. And it was the first step on this road to universality.
And before this, scientists thought that the heavens were ruled by separate principles from the
Absolutely,
Earth.
Absolutely, yes. If you go back to the what was probably the most successful scientific theory of all time, which was the old Greek solar system of planets moving on celestial crystal spheres. It was felt that since the planets were moving in circles, that was natural. You didn't need a force. It was perfect. That was the way the world was out there. But, of course, very different from what we have down here, because on Earth things don't move that way.
My guest is physicist James Trefel, and his new book is called Reading the Mind of God in Search of the Principle of Universality. Now, heaven is both a religious concept and a religious location,
mm-hmm. yes.
as well as the word that we use to describe the universe beyond us. The title of your new book is Reading the Mind of God. Mm-hmm. How does that concept of the mind of God apply to this theory of universality?
Well, we live in an age when science is seen as being very rational and essentially agnostic, if not atheistic. And one of the great shocks that you have when you start reading the history of science is how many of the important scientists were deeply religious men. For example, Newton and William Herschel, the first man who mapped the stars in the sky, really believed that what they were doing was discovering what was in the mind of God at the creation. You know, they were finding out how the universe worked, and to them that was a religious act. This is not the way we do science today, but it's the way they did it then.
So by discovering the physical laws, scientists believed that they were also discovering what was in the mind of God.
Yeah, what was basically a religious truth. It was discovering an aspect of God.
How do you see a religion and science tying together now?
Well, there's been a long history of antagonism between the two. I think rather needless antagonism. There are many scientists who are religious. There are many scientists who are not. And the usual, my own view, is that the two need not be connected. That is, science deals with a very specific set of, very specific subject matter. It deals with the physical operation of the universe. And whether that has to do with the existence of a God or any kind of religious belief is immaterial. It just doesn't, you know, they don't need to connect. I think there are problems. There are sort of imperial scientists who want to say, well, there's a material world and nothing else. And then there are religious imperialists who want to impose their views on the way the physical world operates. And neither one of them have had much success.
I want to get back to the principle of universality. If mm-hmm. we didn't accept that the laws of science on Earth also apply throughout the universe, would we be able to deduce anything about the universe?
Of course not, because, I mean, if you look at a distant star or a distant galaxy and see something, you wouldn't know how to interpret it. The fact that we look at distant galaxies and see that the light is slightly different from what you would get if you were standing there on that galaxy is what we use to deduce the fact that the universe is expanding. If you didn't know what the light was supposed to look like when it came from that galaxy, i.e. if you didn't know what atoms there behaved like, you couldn't understand the structure of the universe. You would be lost. You could find out about Earth, and maybe the solar system now that we've sent probes out past Neptune, but that would be it. You could only say that that your knowledge extended as far as you had gone physically.
Your previous book has just come out in paperback. It's called The Dark Side of the Universe, mm-hmm. A Scientist Explores the Mysteries of the Cosmos. One of the mysteries you explore in that book is that the universe is constantly expanding. This is a greatly confusing concept to me, since we think of the universe as being infinitely large. How can infinity expand?
There are problems in conceptualizing this. The easiest way I know to think about it is one way to think about something like this, something that doesn't have an edge, doesn't have an ending, but yet is bounded, is to think about walking around the inside of a basketball. You know, you start at one place, you walk around, and pretty soon you come back to where you began, but you never got to the end. And many people who think about the universe think of it in terms somewhat like that.
Yeah, but a basketball isn't infinitely sized.
No, but what you mean by being infinite, it has no edge. There's no place you can come to the end and say, okay, it stops here and something else starts, you see.
But it has that rim, you know.
Well,
you know,
it has
contained.
A, okay.
It has
yes,
a skin
I
on it.
I understand, yes.
And I think of it as this, like,
yeah.
You know, endless. There's no roof. There's no top. There's no bottom. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's several ways you can sort of fudge about that. Since the universe is only about 15 billion years old, the known universe, that is the universe we know about, is 15 billion light years in radius. I mean, that we know. What's beyond that is in a sense, not really something we can talk about because it's not something we can ever see. But the other problem is that in dealing with this, it's hard to say, you cannot visualize in more than three dimensions. The human brain just wasn't built that way. And to understand this kind of expansion, you have to think in four dimensions. And the best you can do is make analogies. But every analogy has its limits.
Mm-hmm.
And you just pointed out the limit of my analogy.
I really have no concept at all of what a fourth, outside of like a few old Rod Serling shows,
yeah.
of what a fourth dimension might be and why we need to think in terms of a fourth dimension to really conceive of the universe.
Okay, well, you know, what you're asking me is actually, if I had to make a list of my 10 least favorite questions, this would be right at the top. What you're asking me in a different way is, if the universe is expanding, what's it expanding into? And the reason that it's not a favorite question of mine is because I haven't thought of a good way to answer it. Let me explain to you why. When I talk to or try to explain in English about scientific concepts, what I'm really doing is the same thing that a translator does when he or she translates a work of poetry from one language to another. I take the question you ask, and I translate it into the language of science, which is mathematics. Mm-hmm. And I look for the answer in that language, and then I translate the answer back into our language, which is English. Now, the problem is when you ask me this question and I try to translate it into mathematics, I find that there's no translation, that the question can't be asked. It's a little like my asking you, well, what's north of the North Pole? And if you think about that for a minute, there's nothing north of the North. At the North Pole, you walk toward the North Pole, suddenly you're walking south again. You can go above the North Pole, but that's not north of the North Pole. You see, it's not that there's nothing north of the North Pole. It's that there's not even nothing north of the North Pole. And so I can't answer the question, and I give up.
So really, like, the word the fourth dimension is just a kind of stand-in for something that's totally out of reach,
out of our
perception.
Well, no, the fourth dimension is supposed to be time. But what you want is a way of picturing that as a fourth dimension, and I can't give you one.
Right. Okay. Mm. When scientists say that the universe is constantly expanding, do they mean our knowledge of it is constantly expanding,
no,
or
they mean
it is physically expanding?
It's physically expanding. The distance between us and neighboring galaxies is increasing. And the analogy that I like to use here is think about bread dough that's rising, you know, when it's sitting in your kitchen. If you have raisins inside the bread dough, the raisins are getting farther and farther apart. You know, and if you think of each raisin as a galaxy, that's what the universe is like. The galaxies are getting farther and farther apart. The whole thing is expanding. Where this analogy breaks down is that we're talking about being outside the bread dough, watching it expand, and it has an edge. Okay? The real case is we're inside the bread dough, and it's expanding, and that's a little bit different.
Do we know why it's expanding? Shall I say,
well,
do you know why it's expanding? Because I sure don't.
No one knows in the sense of giving a specific reason. The theories that we have, the explanations that we have to do with the way the universe originated. It originated in a very hot, very dense state, and hot, dense things tend to expand. And it's just like letting steam out of a kettle. The steam expands. And so the kind of expansion that we're seeing now is sort of a leftover of that early expansion, that early hotness.
Okay, well, I want to talk with you more about science and cosmology, but first we'll take a short break. My guest is James Treffel, and he writes books that explain complicated scientific principles in simple and engaging ways. His new book is called Reading the Mind of God in Search of the Principle of Universality. You may have also have heard James Treffel's commentaries on NPR's Morning Edition. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Science writer and Professor James Treffel is my guest. We left off, I believe, in the middle of a constantly expanding universe. Mm-hmm. Is it currently believed now that the universe will eventually kind of burn itself out?
Well, the best idea now is that it will keep on expanding, getting more and more tenuous. The stars will burn out, and it'll just sort of coast to a stop after an infinite time has passed. In other words, it's not, as some science fiction writers have suggested in the past, a case where the expansion will reverse, everything will fall back in on itself. Instead of a big bang, we'll have a big crunch, and then the whole thing starts again. Our best theory now is that probably that won't happen.
Your recent book, The Dark Side of the Universe, this is the one that just came out in paperback, mm-hmm. spends a lot of time describing dark matter and how our knowledge of that has been adding to the knowledge that scientists have about the universe. Can you give us a kind of basic explanation of what that is?
Yeah, it turns out, and this is one of perhaps the most shocking discovery of the last 10 years in cosmology, is that at least 90%, and maybe as much as 99% of the universe, is in a form that we don't know and is not visible. I mean, we look out, we see galaxies, we see stars, we think, aha, that's the universe. It's all that visible stuff. It's stuff that's like us, you know, made out of the same stuff that we are. But by looking carefully at galaxies, watching how they rotate, watching how they interact with each other, you can tell that there's more stuff there than you can see. You can tell because it exerts a gravitational force on the stuff you can see. And the Milky Way, for example, our own galaxy, is at least 90% made of this other stuff, whatever it is. Now, the problem is that, I mean, this other stuff is there, we know it's there, but we have no idea what it is. The one thing that seems pretty certain is it's not stuff like us. It's not made out of the same kind of material that we are. It's something very different, something we haven't seen in our laboratories. So we're in a situation where we've spent centuries, you know, gaining this very tenuous knowledge of the universe, only to discover that what we've explored is one little corner of this tremendous unknown expanse that's waiting out there for us right now.
I'm a little confused. The dark matter is it's a concept that's new in science. It's going to explain a lot about what kind of organizes the universe,
mm-hmm.
but we can't see it. We don't know what it is. Can you explain a little bit more about what it is?
Well,
what we think it might be?
Yes. Basically, if you think of the galaxies and the things that we do see, you think of the spiral galaxies you see in pictures, as being embedded in some kind of a matrix, that matrix is the dark matter. We think that the dark matter is organized in ways that explain how galaxies are organized. In other words, it's like looking at an ocean. You see a set of islands in the ocean. You know there's a sort of an undersea mountain chain there. The dark matter is like the undersea mountain chain. The galaxies we see are like the islands. The reason I stress the mystery of the dark matter is because, as it's a new discovery, we really don't know much about it. We know what it does or what it's supposed to do. We know that it's there, but we don't know its identity. And until we know that, we really are ignorant of the major component of the universe.
Mm-hmm. And we don't have the tools to explore what's beyond our perception.
Well, I think it's not that we can't do it. It's just that it's such a new idea that nobody really knows quite what to do with it. And people are starting to gear up to learn more about it, to try to see if we can't reproduce it in the laboratories, whatever this stuff is. And by studying in detail the way it behaves to try to get some sense of what, you know, just what it is really, there are lots of far out ideas, but no very few firm ideas.
In one of your books, you quote a poet named Steve Weinberg who once said, "The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless." Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you shared his perception.
Not really. He's a Nobel laureate physicist, but he. I think he wrote that in a moment of gloom, contemplating this, what I talked about before, the universe expanding and eventually just disappearing. But, I mean, the fact that a quadrillion years from now the universe is going to be very different from what it is now and perhaps not hospitable to living things really doesn't make much difference as to how we're going to live our lives, you know, while we have them here. And so I don't see that it has much much effect.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't make me gloomy.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand, and I don't know exactly what this means, but I understand that the world's largest particle accelerator recently opened in Europe. What's in it for me, if you know what I mean?
Whether it's not the world's largest, it's a major installation in Europe. The world's largest is just outside of Chicago at the moment, and it will be, assuming plans go ahead, it will be in Texas, in this new superconducting supercollider in Texas during the next decade. What's in it for you? Well, there are two kinds of things that are in it for you, depending on, you know, what you want. There's intellectual satisfaction, just being part of this, the generation that solves the ultimate mystery of the physical nature of the universe. We're very close to that. But I would say, let me be more crass, and this is not for you, but what's in it for, you know, John Q. Public. There is a long history of basic research paying off. I mean, paying off in dollars. I mean, just to give you some examples, the Apollo program, which everybody dumped on during the 60s, the estimates are that for every dollar that was spent on the Apollo program, $7 in economic activity was generated in the economy in the next decade. So this was an example of basic research paying off. We live in an age when technological leadership is extremely important because the cutting edge, I mean, the American economy is going to depend more and more on our maintaining some kind of technological leadership. So in essence, what you're doing when you build a particle accelerator is you're making sure that your grandchildren will have the kind of scientific tools that we inherited from our grandparents, and we'll be able to move ahead as in fields of technology.
How did you get into writing books about science for non-scientists, trying to explain these incredibly complicated concepts and theories to people like me who don't follow science closely but, you know, are curious about it?
What actually happened is I gave a public lecture in about quarks. This is back in the early 70s, and quarks, you know, are supposed to be the fundamental constituents of matter. And one of my students, who's now a big shot at Lockheed, but was a graduate student at that time, came up to me afterwards and said, you know, you really ought to publish that because there are a lot of people who would like to read that. And I sent it off to Smithsonian Magazine, and they published it. And after that, I realized that there really was an important mission here that I could do.
Well, I think science continues to become more and more incomprehensible to people who aren't experts.
Well, that's true, and it's becoming more incomprehensible even to professional physicists. And I find that, you know, at professional meetings, people will sidle up to me and say, "Hey, listen, I really enjoyed your book, and I learned all about cosmology by reading these things." And these are professional astronomers or physicists who are telling me this. So you're not the only one who needs it.
Well, James Treffel, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
My pleasure.
James Treffel's new book, Reading the Mind of God in Search of the Principle of Universality, is published by Scribner's. An earlier book, The Dark Side of the Universe, has just come out in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, former California Governor Edmund Brown reflects on the 36 death sentences that were carried out during his 8 years in office. His new book is called Public Justice, Private Mercy, A Governor's Education on Death Row. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Kirk Harvey and John Clifford only made one feature film, an obscure, low-budget horror film called Carnival of Souls. Both George Romero and Rod Serling cited this 1962 film as an influence on their work. The film only showed in a few drive-ins and on late-night TV, but now it's back in circulation. Coming up, Harvey and Clifford tell the story behind the film and its revival. Also, film critic Peter Rayner checks in from the Montreal Film Festival. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The case against Panama's General Noriega was outlined at a special meeting of the Organization of American States today, a meeting called by the United States to provide Deputy Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger a chance to answer a Panamanian challenge. Last week, after Eagleburger said that Noriega had turned Panama into a haven for drug dealers and a center for money laundering, the Panamanian ambassador demanded, if you have the evidence, show it. NPR's Neil Cohen reports.
Deputy Secretary Eagleburger called Panamanian charges bunk. General Noriega, he said, stands accused of the most serious violations of U.S. law. Outlining the charges handed up by two federal grand juries in Florida, he said the allegations were simple and chilling. But Noriega's abuse of power and venality, he said, is not limited to drug trafficking. Eagleburger charged that Noriega had abused his own institution, the Panamanian Defense Forces, that he'd offered to assassinate the Sandinista leadership in Nicaragua, that he contributed directly to a military rebellion in Argentina, and that he supported and protected drug traffickers in Colombia. The problem, Eagleburger said, is Noriega. Earlier, during a point of order, the Panamanian representative here denounced the United States for carrying on what he described as a campaign of propaganda and disinformation aimed at destabilizing the Panamanian government. At the Organization of American States, this is Neil Conan reporting.
A Senate committee today heard testimony about a new generation of illegal drugs already on the street in cities and towns across the country. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
The drugs are many, and so are the street names, crank, croak, moonrock. Witnesses testified that the newest thing is smoking a combination of crack, an upper, and heroin, a downer. And it's not only the poor who are hooked on smoking crack and heroin. Witnesses said middle-class users favor smoking a blend of heroin and crack that is burned on aluminum foil. Senator Joseph Biden, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, called today's hearing.
The drug cartels, like any successful marketers of a product, are constantly working on new and improved models. New and improved models of their wares.
Biden will give the Democratic response after President Bush delivers a speech outlining the country's drug strategy next week. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
A powerful bomb explosion killed one person and wounded several others today in Medellin, Colombia. The bomb blast destroyed 30 cars and badly damaged nearby buildings. Hundreds of people were arrested overnight in Medellin, where today's explosion capped a week-long wave of bombings. There's now a nighttime curfew in that city and nine others in Colombia. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. This is the story of a horror film which, like its main character, has come back from the dead. The low-budget Carnival of Souls went completely unnoticed when it was released in 1962. It played in so few theaters, hardly anyone got to see it. But now it's back in distribution, getting some very good reviews. Terrence Rafferty in The New Yorker called it bleak, unnerving. You're immersed in it, and when you come up, the world looks stranger. My guests are John Clifford, the writer, and Herc Harvey, the director of the film. They worked together for decades in an educational film company called Centron in Lawrence, Kansas. Carnival of Souls is their only feature film. It's the story of a church organist who's killed in a car that drives off a bridge into the river. Somehow she mysteriously walks out of the river and resumes her life. But she's trapped in a world between life and death. A phantom is following her to take her back to the world of the dead where she belongs. the phantom eventually possesses her and her music.
Profane, sacrilege, what are you playing in this church? Have you no respect? Do you feel no reverence? And I feel sorry for you and your lack of soul. This organ, the music of this church, these things have meaning and significance to us. I assume they did to you. But without this awareness, I'm afraid you cannot be our organist.
The inspiration for Carnival of Souls was an abandoned amusement park on the outskirts of Salt Lake City that Herc Harvey found on a drive back from the West Coast.
It was one of the weirdest places I ever saw. And I stopped the car, looked at it for a minute, and thought, I got to get closer to this. So I walked down this long causeway out into the salt area, and there was this old deserted amusement park. And I came back and told John, I said, you know, this is a terrific location. I think we can use some of the local locations and locations there and make a good feature film. John then fleshed out the ideas that we used.
This is a film that's really about complete alienation, about being incapable of making contact with other people, or as one character puts it, living in isolation from the human race. Were either of you experiencing that kind of alienation when you made this movie? Do I hear a laugh?
Yes, you do. No, I don't think so at all. No.
I don't believe so. No, it was... No, it wasn't.
Well, you sure did a compelling job, though, of expressing that kind of emotion. It must have come from somewhere.
Partly it was a creative decision to keep this woman away from all sympathy and help and to share the idea of being totally stranded and facing something that you can't explain.
Why did you want to do this as a horror film? Because really, the emotions that you're talking about here, this feeling of alienation and disconnection, I mean, these are subjects that have been addressed by philosophy and psychology. Why did you want to do it as a horror film?
I think basically on that, we just didn't want to get into the monster situation because with the budget we had and that sort of thing, this could lend itself to the kind of production we could do. And we thought also it would be a little more novel than some of the monster films that had been done at that time. We thought that a psychological thriller, doing something that's a little unknown, that sort of thing, would be a little more interesting than the straight monster film, which to us was a cliche at that time.
Herc Harvey, what are some of the horror films that you liked of the 50s and early 60s that were perhaps inspiration in some way for your own film?
Well, I think basically, as a kid, of course, I went to see and was scared by Frankenstein and Dracula, and the usual ones. I think later on, about the time I started working at Centron, I started getting acquainted with Cocteau films, and they intrigued me. Blood of a Poet, Beauty and the Beast, and of course, I used to come over here to Kansas City all the time to the fine arts theaters to see Bergman films. And I think some of those had an effect on me in the way I directed the film.
I want to ask you about a couple of the images from the film that really stand out in my memory. One is, this is toward the end, in this abandoned dance pavilion, there's all of the lost souls, all of the ghoul-like people are dancing around, but there is no music. It's a very eerie, wonderful image. Herc Harvey, can you talk about creating the look of that?
Well, this was one of the reasons I think we decided to do the film in that location, because I had seen that location, and I think that's one of the weirdest locations. And actually, I think the idea of the dance and all was just fit to the location, because we knew that was there. As a matter of fact, we lost a half a reel of film of all the ghouls coming to the dance, because they come out of the lake from behind the pylons and things that are out in the lake, and then there's this walk towards, you just see these black figures walking on that white salt, and then the scenes of them climbing up into the pavilion, this kind of thing. But that half reel, that roll of film, rather, was lost in the lab. But the atmosphere in the dance itself was not one that was hard to imagine. The only thing that was hard for us to imagine was using the troupe of dance kids from Salt Lake, from Utah University as the actors, And yet, the fact that they're young and all doesn't seem to be that much of a detriment to the scene. It still seems to come across.
Another scene. The main character, the woman who's living in between life and death, she's in a dressing room trying on a dress in a department mm-hmm. store. And she comes out and she realizes that for the moment she's become invisible. No one can either hear nor see her. It's a very, also a very eerie moment in which she's temporarily tuned out of life.
It was more than just not being able to hear anything or make contact with anyone. It was as though for a time I didn't exist. As though I had no place in the world, no part of the life around me.
I remember in the first draft that scene wasn't in there. We were talking one day about in the middle of the film needed something, and I can't remember which one of us suggested it, but I remember in our conversation we came out with this idea of suspending her, of having her disappear for a while from life and then go back and forth in that way. I remember us sitting in the apartment thinking of that idea, but I can't remember mm-hmm. exactly how it came up.
Herk Harvey, you cast yourself as the phantom who keeps following this woman who's living between life and death, following her to finally bring her back to the world of the dead where she belongs because she was actually killed in this car crash. Tell me why you cast yourself in that role.
That's my purpose in life. No, strictly economics.
Uh-huh. Well, you could have cast yourself in
another
role.
A little bit of ham.
Yeah.
A little bit of ham, yes. Sure, you know, if you're going to do it, you might as well go all out and do it, right. No, part of it was the fact that I knew I was going to take three actors to Salt Lake, Mary Henry, the doctor, and the minister. And that was it budget-wise, and so, you know, it was just much easier on location rather than having somebody come in on the spur of the moment and do it, to go ahead and cast yourself and do it. Although, I always wanted to play a monster, really. I mean, that's, you know, acting. I majored in acting in college, and I enjoy it.
What kind of makeup did you use?
That went through a transitional stage, too, because I experimented considerably. At first, I was going to use egg whites, because beating up egg whites and using certain other things like starch and that sort of thing with it, I could make a nice flaky-looking face that really had a nice look to it. But it took me over an hour to put that on. And directing and acting both, I found out that it just didn't work that way. And so I just used regular white stage makeup and darkened the eyes. It took about 10 minutes to get the makeup on.
The main character in this movie is a church organist, and she plays some pretty bizarre music mm-hmm. through the course of the movie. I think the organ is a really perfect touch, since organs have been used as a musical accompaniment for some horror films. And also playing church organ, I mean, after all, that is the place of the soul. mm-hmm. You know, in a house of religion. Tell me about making the organ such an important part of the film.
This may sound a little prosaic after what you just said, but there happens to be an organ factory in Lawrence, Kansas. And I knew they had this magnificent room where they test the organs. And I was thinking of ways that we could use whatever facilities we could find to put production values in the show. And I thought there ought to be some way I could use that organ factory. And then I thought, well, make the girl an organist. And everything else kind of fell in line from that idea.
My guests are John Clifford and Herk Harvey, the writer and director of Carnival of Souls, a low-budget horror film first released in 1962. The film, which was poorly distributed at the time, has since been seen only on late-night TV, but it's just been re-released. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Herk Harvey and John Clifford are my guests, and we're talking about their 1962 horror film, Carnival of Souls. Now, George Romero has said that Carnival of Souls was one of the inspirations behind his Night of the Living Dead. Who were some of the inspirations for you, Herc Harvey, in terms of making a cheap, independent horror film?
Well, at that time, there were a lot of people that were doing this, and probably Bob Altman over in Kansas City. I had just finished making about 4 films for Elmer Roden, who at that time owned Commonwealth Theaters in Kansas City, and they had gotten together and made Juvenile the Delinquents. They made about 4 films, and not the horror variety. Most of them were either cops and robbers or like the Delinquents at that time. This was the 60s, and that was a topic that was favorable. And we just saw them doing it and thought that the horror genre would be pretty good to get into as far as making enough money back to make another film.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did
which was really the reason we made it.
Oh, so you used this as a movie to make another movie?
Sure.
Yeah, which you never did. That this is the great mystery. It's really, I think, such a wonderful and intriguing movie, and you never made another theatrical feature again.
That's true.
Well, you see, the best laid plans of mice and men all go to hell when a distributor steals all the money.
Is that what happened?
That's what happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, couldn't you have made another movie as cheap as the first one and tried again?
Oh, sure. The only thing is, at that age, and having to face those people that did invest in that one takes a lot of the spark out, plus the fact that we were totally employed by Centron, and we had both taken, like John did it, in the off hours for about 3 weeks, and I took 3 weeks of vacation to shoot the film.
So you had no more vacation time, right?
So I had no more vacation time at that time, but had we made the money back, then that would have made a chance, you know, to go in other directions. But as it was, we just simply got back into the mode of making educational industrial films, and we're very happy in that, I might add.
Yeah, we were fully employed in filmmaking in a nice situation. It was.
What kinds of educational industrial films have you done over the years?
Oh, goodness, I couldn't name them. We did industrial films for most of the big corporations, from General Motors, American Medical Association, John Deere, Caterpillar, safety films, informational films, and for the educational market, we've covered about every subject I can think of. We had our own, Centron had its own educational division, and we sold our own CEF educational films.
So tell me what happened with this distributor, the one who lost all your money for you?
Well, this was Hertz Lion Corporation in Los Angeles, and their names were given to us by General Labs at that time, and it was a very straightforward presentation because it was a stock-held company, and they said it had just been formed, and Mr. Ken Hertz at that time was the president. And basically, he took our film and 6 from Texas, then he bought several films from England and started a distribution company and was doing fine. We got early reports that it was doing all right. It only showed, basically, as a double feature in southeastern United States, mainly in drive-ins. And after a while, he owed us so much money, and I got back from a trip, well, just before I went on a trip to South America, he sent me a check, it bounced, and I knew we were in trouble. The next thing I know, he's out of the country, and I'm in South America, and it's hard to communicate as to what to do. We tried to trace him, and that was it. The money was gone.
So how do you feel now when you see it again, especially when you see it in a repertory or art screening house? What makes you really proud and what makes you cringe because you wish you'd done it better?
A lot of it makes me cringe. I wince when I hear some of the dialogue today. And that was the first film I wrote. And I never told Herc, but I went to the library and looked up the difference between a close-up and a medium shot. And then I wrote the film in about 3 weeks. And since then, we've each done several hundred short films. And so there's a great deal in it that I would do different as a writer today. But maybe some of that awkwardness helps. I don't know.
I would do the sound effects of the footsteps considerably different.
Oh, I was going to bring that up.
Yeah, no.
There's one real flaw I was going to mention. There's a scene where the main character, the leading lady, is like running through a train station, and she's wearing high heels, and the clip-clop of her feet is so out of sync with her steps.
tell me about it?
Well,
no, we both, this was one of the things that when we saw that, it's one of those things that, as I said, we were on an absolutely strict schedule. I told the investors I would absolutely not come back to them for more funds, that we would make the film for this cost. So we sat there one night, and I did the Foley work with a pair of ladies' shoes on a piece of plywood, pounding away to picture and saying, "No, that's good enough, forget it, it'll work." And in retrospect, it was a very, very bad decision.
I have to ask, you said earlier that the alienation that's expressed in this movie isn't something that you were both personally feeling. But I can't help but wonder if you maybe felt more alienated than you're letting on after this movie came out while you were working at the Educational Film Company. Because it seems that you're both, I don't know, that you both have spirits that are a little bit odd, a little offbeat, and that you might have felt just a little too offbeat for where you were working.
Well, that's probably something to that. Maybe we leave it buried. We have scripts today. We're ready to go on movies right now if anybody wants to come up with the money.
Well, are you hoping that that's going to be a result of the revival of Carnival of Souls?
My own feeling is that I can take it or leave it. Because one of the nice things that happens is this is all a bonus as far as I'm concerned, because I have had a very good career, proud of the films I've made, and some of them, that is. But basically, it was great. I got to travel all around the world and do things, meet a lot of interesting people, so I don't know what more I would want. Except, you know, you do think, well, okay, one feature film, that doesn't say much. Ought to do it some more.
Herc Harvey, John Clifford, thank you both very much.
Terry, well, the fact you that you much. Saw our film twice makes us love you dearly.
That's right.
And thank you for calling us.
Director Herc Harvey and writer John Clifford spoke to us from KCUR in Kansas City. Their 1962 movie, Carnival of Souls, will be screened at upcoming film festivals in Toronto, Boston, and Denver, and at theaters in Minneapolis, Cincinnati, Philadelphia, and San Francisco.
They're everywhere. They're not going to let me go. Everywhere I turn, something that's blocking my escape. He's trying to prevent me from living. He's trying to take me back somewhere. I can't fight anymore. I don't know what's real anymore. Doctor, you've got to tell me what to do.
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. NPR's Alex Chadwick continues his reporting from Poland on the anniversary of the German invasion in 1939. Also, reports from Colombia, 500 more have been arrested in Medellin for curfew violation. Several people injured in a rocket attack in that city. Medellin is said to be the headquarters for the drug operations in Colombia. And we'll take up the issue of slogans for license plates. The District of Columbia is considering a new slogan. Currently, this slogan is in use, Washington, a capital city. And the columnist David Berry has suggested Washington, a humid place. The issue is also under discussion in Texas, and we'll talk with Ann Richards, running for governor there.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Every year there are international film festivals in places like Cannes, Telluride, Berlin, and New York. The largest and most widely attended film festival in North America is now underway in Montreal. Film critic Peter Rayner of the Los Angeles Herald Examiner is covering the Montreal Film Festival and is joining us on the telephone. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Terry.
What's the importance of the Montreal Film Festival?
Well, the importance basically is just to showcase as many films from all over the world as you can possibly pack into 10 days. There are something like 550 screenings from 48 different countries, and about 300,000 people are supposed to be buying tickets. So it's really an opportunity to see movies from all over the world that you might not normally see in your local multiplex, or at least not for a while.
Do most of these films have distributors, or are they there to find that?
Well, I'd say about half of them have distributors, although in many cases they don't have distribution in all the territories around the world. The rest of them, particularly in the marketplace section of the festival, are actively pursuing deals, and you can't get in an elevator in this hotel here without somebody mentioning the word deal in some language or other.
Is there any one film that you have taken a special interest in that's been screened so far at the festival?
Well, the festival's about halfway through now, and I'd say of the pictures I've seen, the Satyajit Ray picture, Enemy of the People, is a wonderful movie. It's an Indian version of the Ibsen play.
What other films have you seen that you've liked?
There's a movie called My Left Foot. It's an Irish picture with Daniel Day-Lewis. He plays Christy Brown, who was a cerebral palsy victim who could only use his left foot and was a painter and a novelist and sort of a terrific guy. And the movie is basically a biopic about Christy Brown, and Day-Lewis does the entire performance basically from a wheelchair. You can hardly hear what he's saying. His movements are spasmodic, but it's an amazing performance. There's a Polish director, Krzysztof Kozłowski, who has done a series of films for Polish television that are getting a tremendous amount of acclaim here. He may be the next sort of hot director on the international scene.
So tell me, after you come back from these festivals, are the best movies usually shown eventually in American movie houses?
Quite often the films that are English language or, say, French or Italian are, but not always. And many of the best movies from, say, India or the Far East or even Canada very often don't get American distribution, or it's several years down the line. The reason for this is that art houses in America are a sort of diminishing quantity, and you don't really have the opportunity to show these films, and there isn't enough of an audience for them. I think if you have a great movie, people will see it. They just have to physically be able to go to a theater and see it. And that's one of the main functions of a film festival, that you're able to write about these movies and alert distributors to them. But I think that of the best films that I've seen here, hopefully all of them will get distribution in America, namely the Ray picture. Even the Polish Decalogues, I think, by Kozłowski will be shown, and My Left Foot will definitely be shown in the fall.
Okay, well, Peter Rayner, thank you very much for reporting for us on the Montreal Film Festival.
Thanks, Terry.
Peter Rayner is film critic for the Los Angeles Herald Examiner and spoke to us from Montreal. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Audrey Verblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
36 convicts were executed in California while Pat Brown was the governor. On the next Fresh Air, the former governor tells us how deciding the fate of convicts on death row changed his stand on the death penalty. Also, a conversation with actress and director Lee Grant and a review of the Rolling Stones' new record. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.
Harrison reveals the true location of Minnesota, all on A Prairie Home Companion.
Join us for A Prairie Home Companion Friday nights at 7 here on 91 FM.
The time is 8 o'clock on 91 FM.